Hello, and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
What we see from the data that there are almost 6,000 infectious syphilis notifications or diagnoses in 2024, which although is a slight decline, represents a doubling over 10 years.
Australia's annual sexual health checkup has been released also.
One bank's told me off the record just 60% of the number, and then that's the basis of seeing if this thing's got any legs to invest in.
We take a look at how the privatised toll road system can be reformed. And later today...
The problem of e-waste is ever growing. So Australia per capita is the highest consumer, and that generates a lot of this e-waste.
An Australian green tech company replacing old solar panels and preventing e-waste in landfills via mechanical recycling processes. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, the National Climate Risk Assessment warns millions of Australians are at risk from rising sea levels and heat-related deaths unless climate change can be limited. According to the landmark report released today, the number of heat-related deaths in Sydney could surge by almost 450% if global heating surpasses 3 degrees. The comprehensive assessment also outlines the risks of longer fire seasons, extreme downpours, rising seas and mega droughts, with flow-on effects for health, food and water security, infrastructure and livelihoods. It comes as the federal government prepares its 2035 climate plan and bids with Pacific nations to co-host the COP31 summit. I spoke to climate expert at Greenpeace Australia Pacific, Dr. Simon Bradshaw, who says the government must respond with stronger climate targets and a rapid phase out of fossil fuels.
This new risk assessment does paint a very frightening picture of our future. If we continue down the path of fossil fuels, there are many striking numbers in there. One is that heat-related deaths in Sydney would increase by 450% under a scenario that sees warming of 3 degrees, which is roughly the trajectory we're on at the moment. We'd also see a massive increase in the stress on our marine ecosystems. This is coral reefs. These are all these things that are so important for our sustenance and for our communities. We'd also see 1.5 million Australians at risk from sea level rise by mid-century, and that would rise to 3 million by the end of the century. That's just some of the numbers that are in here. But one of the most important things to take out of this report is it's very much still our future to choose, because there is a profound difference in the impacts that we see at those high levels of warming through continued burning of fossil fuels, through failure to take strong enough action, and what we see if we do everything possible to limit warming to 1.5 degrees.
And we've already reached or surpassed the benchmark of 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And as you mentioned, these impacts in the assessment were kind of modelled under the scenarios of above 2 degrees or above 3 degrees. How quickly are we approaching these in real time?
Look, we are minutes to midnight. We really are teetering on the edge of very serious consequences, because if we push our climate system beyond these tipping points, these one-way doors that we don't want to go through, that we'd see sudden, abrupt and irreversible changes, then of course that is a whole world of pain for our communities and ecosystems down the line. Importantly, yes, we last year temporarily did see temperatures rise to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. We've not yet hit a long-term average of 1.5 degrees, although we are perilously close. And so that's why this target that Australia's about to set is so important. And if we look at the science, if we look at Australia's fair share of the global task, we should be aiming to hit net zero emissions by 2035 and have that be accompanied by a fair and fast phase out of fossil fuels, because every ton of carbon we leave in the ground, every fraction of a degree of avoided warming, that is lives and livelihoods saved, a safer future for our communities and ecosystems. It's the steps we take right now that are going to be so consequential.
And it's quite timely, especially in the last couple of days, we've seen the approval of the Northwest Shelf. And the government seems to have delayed in releasing the report. Why does that matter, or why is that so concerning?
Well, we have to say right now, the government's credibility on climate is hanging by a thread. Now, this is disappointing because, of course, they were elected with a very strong mandate for stronger action on climate change and a thumping majority to work with. What's in this report is essential information for communities to be able to plan for the future, to build their resilience to the impacts of climate change. This report should not have been held back. And of course, it is a crucial input to this decision around Australia's next climate targets. Approving new fossil fuels in 2025 or extending the life of our largest fossil fuel project, in the case of the North West Shelf, that flies in the face of the science. I mean, that is a slap in the face to vulnerable Australian communities and to Pacific communities throughout our region in particular, who have fought so hard for stronger action on climate change.
In terms of a response from the Albanese government with the upcoming climate plan, I think of similar data that's been released, and a lot of response from leaders isn't necessarily equal to the risk that's kind of being responded to. What are you hoping for in terms of that climate plan?
I think you're spot on that we are thankfully through that period of flat out climate denial, except for a very small but vocal minority of people. The real risk now is climate delay, is inadequate solutions, is yes, making some progress on renewable energy, but continuing to double down on fossil fuels, including gas, on sort of framing things as practical or achievable, not as actually what's necessary and what we can really achieve and what we need to go for. So this report does lay out, probably in the clearest terms you've ever seen, just how grave the consequences are and how they cascade across society, affecting health, affecting our physical security, affecting our cost of living, affecting the places that we love. The responsible way to respond to this is to throw everything we've got at it. It's a fair, fast phase out of fossil fuels. Of course, that begins with ending the reckless approval of new projects like Woodside's Northwest Shelf. It means really tapping into our renewable energy potential. It means at the same time, supporting communities who are particularly vulnerable with adapting to the impacts that can no longer be avoided. It has to be informed by science. It has to be taking the fossil fuel interests out of the equation. It has to be recognizing that everything we do now is a safer future and seeing just the gravity of the decisions we make now. We've been a big part of the problem in the past. We can, if we want, be a big part of the solution. Australia is blessed with enormous potential to punch above our weight here. The only thing holding that potential back is the nefarious influence of the fossil fuel industry. And we've seen in the lead up to setting this 2035 targets, the Business Council of Australia really acting as a mouthpiece for the fossil fuel industry, trying to put the brakes on what could otherwise be a very strong target. So the economics are favourable. There's the support from the electorate and the mandate for stronger action. We've got this almost unique opportunity in Australia with renewable energy and potential new clean industries. And of course, it is now so urgent what we do. Every decision we make now, every bit of avoided warming, that's a safer, more secure, more prosperous future.
Dr. Simon Bradshaw there from Greenpeace Australia Pacific, ending that report.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Australia's annual sexual health checkup has been released, showing HIV cases are declining, but other STIs, such as syphilis and gonorrhea, have doubled over the last 10 years. While chlamydia cases are relatively stable, it remains the most commonly diagnosed STI in Australia. The data also shows rates of STIs are higher in First Nations communities and regional areas. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with epidemiologist at the Kirby Institute, Dr. Skye McGregor, about the research and what needs to be done to reduce these numbers.
So what we see from the data that there were almost 6,000 infectious syphilis notifications or diagnoses in 2024, which although is a slight decline between 2023 and 2024, represents a doubling over 10 years. And while the majority of notifications, around 80%, are among men, the number of women notified with infectious syphilis has quadrupled in that 10-year period. And concerningly, this rise among women has contributed to syphilis in pregnancy, which can cause miscarriage, stillbirth, congenital syphilis, and infant death. And unfortunately, there were 103 congenital syphilis cases between 2015 and 2024, and tragically, 34 infants died. And I think we need to remember that congenital syphilis is a really serious outcome and can result in lifelong disability. And as a consequence of these syphilis data, in August, Australia's Chief Medical Officer, Professor Michael Kidd, declared syphilis a communicable disease incidence of national significance. And this really reflects the priority and need to respond to syphilis in Australia. We also have a report card on gonorrhea, where we've found that gonorrhea has doubled in the 10-year period 2015 to 2024, with over 44,000 cases, and the majority of these are among men as well. When we look at chlamydia, it remains the most frequently notified sexually transmissible infection in Australia, with over 100,000 cases in 2024. And around half of these are among people aged 20 to 29. And finally, if we look at HIV, there were 757 notifications in 2024, which does represent a 27% decline over the 10-year period.
Now, you were mentioning the statistics about the STIs rising and HIV declining. Were you surprised by these results?
Yeah, so Eduardo, what we've seen, not just in Australia, but globally, is increases in STIs and declines, particularly in Australia and HIV. And I guess there's a couple of reasons behind this. For the increases in STIs, it's complex, but we know there's a range of factors. And so things like persistent inequities in access to healthcare, including gaps in access to culturally appropriate healthcare and timely testing and treatment. And this is particularly in regional and remote settings. This all contributes to increases. For women giving birth to an infant with congenital syphilis, we know that the majority were diagnosed late in pregnancy. So again, this really suggests issues with access to care and testing. We know that the social determinants of health, so these are the non-medical factors that impact on health, so income, education, employment, job security, food insecurity, they also contribute to increases in STIs through poorer access to healthcare. Among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, we've seen a concerted effort by Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations to increase particularly syphilis testing. However, we know we need to do more on testing too. A study led by the Kirby Institute called the Australian Study of Health and Relationships found that only 16% of people aged 16 to 49 reported having had an STI test. So there's a big gap there.
You mentioned earlier in one of the most concerning STIs on the rise is congenital syphilis. Can you please tell us a little bit in a nutshell what it is and why it's so dangerous?
Yeah, so congenital syphilis is when a pregnant person has syphilis during pregnancy, and untreated, that can be passed on to the infant. And particularly in the early stages of infection, the risk of passing on to the infant is really high. And so this can result in miscarriage, stillbirth, or congenital syphilis. And for congenital syphilis, that can result in lifelong disability for that infant. So it has significant impacts on the individual, but also the family and the community for which that infant is in. And as I said, also the stillbirth. So as we see, 34 infants died of congenital syphilis in the last 10 years. And this is an entirely preventable outcome.
So what can we do as a community to reduce these numbers? And what else is needed to reduce the numbers, particularly in remote areas and First Nations communities?
Yeah, thanks, Eduardo. So it's really important to remind ourselves that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities do experience a disproportionate burden of sexually transmissible infections. So we see rates 2 to 5 times higher among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples compared to non-Indigenous peoples. And these rates are even higher in rural and remote settings, as you've said. And I think there's a number of things we need to do. I think we need to ensure development and appropriate resourcing of affordable, accessible and culturally safe healthcare options. And this needs to be done in partnership with impacted communities. And this will ensure testing, treatment and care for everyone who needs it. And there's a range of testing options. It's really important to have point of care testing available for chlamydia and gonorrhea, particularly in remote settings. And for HIV testing, ensuring, again, a range of testing options, including access to self-testing. Stigma and discrimination are still pervasive for STIs and bloodborne viruses, particularly HIV. And we need to ensure that we're having discussions with sexual partners and healthcare providers and increasing our efforts to reduce stigma and discrimination around STIs and HIV.
Dr. Skye McGregor from the Kirby Institute there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM, to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC, and to the other side of the country, on Radio Gallari in Broome, Western Australia. In recent decades, Australia has become highly dependent on privatised toll roads, with many problems and hidden costs impacting taxpayers. The cities of Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne together have 22 private toll roads, with major transportation company Transurban running 18 of them. So how should the current road funding system in the country be reformed? The Wire's Tony Pankaluik spoke to Professor David Henshaw, founding director of the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies at the University of Sydney, to find out.
On the basis of the competitive process, government would select the bidder they prefer, and then they would give them a long-term concession. Typically, they've been rather generous in order to argue that people wouldn't be putting in their money if it was a short-term effort. So they're giving them 20 to 30-year concessions. And the major issue here is that the government is offloading much of the risk associated with developing new infrastructure on the assumption that they couldn't afford it themselves, even though they could raise money at a lower cost. But they wanted to get that off their government balance sheet because it looked better for them.
In your article that you co-authored, we'll dive more deep into this, like the challenges in relying on the current model. You outlined in great detail several of the issues. Could you talk a little bit about each of them, what they entail for listeners?
I think the most important one is the patronage risk. In order for the private consortia to raise money, they need to forecast the amount of traffic that's going to use the toll road, i.e. the amount of revenue they would generate. And in comparing that against the cost of building, operating the asset, that would be the basis of identifying an interest as to whether a bank or another financial institution would want to invest or would be the mechanism to get money from other sources to invest into this investment because they want to get a return. So the return on investment is going to be very much conditioned on how successful you are in generating traffic or business onto your network. Problem is, historically, and I've been involved in many of these projects on the consortia side, is that the companies like Transurban or Transfield or all the other groups that are involved in these things have been pushing high patronage forecasts to make the deal look better than historically it's turned out to be. That's the most important issue that is known as optimism bias. And I should tell you also is that over the years, equity partners have got wise to the fact that every single bid historically as patronage forecast way above what's actually happened. In fact, I can tell you it took 10 years with the M2 in Sydney to reproduce the original baseline traffic forecasts on the road. Now, lessons have been learned through time, and there's been two responses to this. First of all, the banks heavily discount the patronage forecasts. One bank's told me off the record just 60% of the number, and then that's the basis of seeing if this thing's got any legs to invest in. Alternatively, there's another model, which is known as the availability payments model, which we actually don't mention in the paper, but it's a model whereby government says, right, we won't go into the equity markets at this stage. We're basically run the thing. And when we know what the patronage forecasts are going to be in terms of settling down to a almost riskless or an acceptable level of risk, then we'll visit the equity partners. What that means is the government needs to carry the debt initially. It's not something the government's been keen on, but it is a model, and it's a model that's been implemented in one toll road in Australia.
So David, I want to talk more about some solutions and just going to the future. What would you like to see as time goes on?
What I would like to see eventually is that we do away with the major error we made in the beginning of fixing the tolls, and this was politicians fixing them at a particular number so that the bidders knew exactly what the income would be for every car or every truck that used the toll road. That's caused huge problems because those prices are totally out of whack with what should be an adjusted price as the traffic level changes, because the objective of a toll road is to save time compared with the free route. And so the price that you pay should reflect the value of the travel time savings. And that's so out of whack, it's not funny now, because we have this fixed toll price that's been indexed in New South Wales at 4% per annum, guaranteed. But if inflation is higher, then the toll company gets the higher number. But if inflation is less, they get 4%. It's a damn good deal to invest. But having said that, just to finish off, I would like to think one day the government should get control back on the pricing of the toll roads and should price the toll roads and the free roads in such a way that the price of using the toll road should be consistent with the travel time savings compared with the free route. If all roads are congested or a little bit thereof, they should contribute so much per kilometre, which at the moment they don't do that.
That was Professor David Henshaw from the University of Sydney there, speaking to The Wire's Tony Pankaluik.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
An Australian green tech company is hoping to tackle the issue of replacing old solar panels and preventing e-waste in landfills through mechanical recycling processes. Australia is home to over 1.3 million tonnes of solar panels, and the industry is approaching a major transition as the first generation of solar installations are now reaching their end of life. With only 15% of solar panels being recycled in Australia, businesses in the solar industry are facing the challenge of what to do with obsolete panels without contributing to e-waste in landfills. The Wire's Tony Pankaluik spoke to Sercel's plant and project lead, Ben Farrelly, as well as national sales manager, Brent Murray, to find out more.
So basically what we do, we're an Australian-owned green tech company. We recycle e-waste, so anything with a battery or a plug, and we recycle solar panels. And we recycle the commodities out of these and put them back into the circular economy.
So as Ben said, e-waste is anything with a battery or a plug. We see that as full of e-resources. So mining companies have spent a lot of time and energy in pulling those minerals out of the ground, and our job is to turn them back into usable minerals again. So extracting them through our patented processes to capture all of those critical minerals along our process to then be able to turn them back into product that can be used within manufacturing again.
Is this the first of its kind, this company, like what you're doing in Australia?
As for our solar recycling facility, it's the only one in the Southern Hemisphere that has this technology. And as for our e-waste processing, we are the only one in the country with this technology as well.
Is this idea, this concept, is it beginning to get sort of widespread adoption? And do we know of any examples, say, internationally, if they're doing something similar to what your company's doing?
So the problem of e-waste is ever growing. So Australia per capita is the highest consumer, and that generates a lot of this e-waste. I think what it is at the moment is that people are not aware of the problem, but more importantly, they're not aware that there is actually a solution for e-waste and the recycling of solar panels. Globally, there are examples of product stewardship schemes or extended producer responsibility schemes that help support the recycling industry. And here at SEC in Queensland, Murray Watt, Federal Minister, was here talking about stewardship schemes that particularly relate to solar panels and how that can help invigorate what is already a very prosperous recycling industry for panels, especially here at Sercel.
What's been the public response like, say, with the communities and what you've done?
We've had a really positive response to what we're doing. I think we're leading the way and informing consumers and customers on what their end-of-life product looks like. I think we still have a little way to go, a bit more education and a lot more recognition across the sector. So programs like this, helping us out with a voice national, would really help get us the support we need.
Now, is there any other talking points that I may have missed? Was there anything you guys would like to just say to listeners just as we wrap up?
I think potentially we have a different process than majority of our competitors. With our solutions, we work from the back end back to the front. So we see a lot of competitors that would like to cherry pick the commodities out of certain e-waste and solar. And then what happens to the rest if it goes to landfill or goes overseas? It hasn't been a very big concern point for them. Whereas we've come from the back end saying, we have a real issue. How do we fix it? Let's start with making sure that nothing goes into the ground or goes overseas. And let's do it all here in Australia. And then we build our processes backwards to achieve that end.
Like I said, Brent?
Ben's touched on it, and I think it's a really important point that our facilities that we've built are as close to as possible zero waste. So we have a couple of really bespoke facilities where we've built those processes around ensuring that our outputs are somebody else's input and refining our process to make sure that those outputs exactly plug straight into their inputs. So at Sercel, we truly believe in the circular economy, and we know that with the right support, be it through a stewardship scheme, that will only enhance our ability to capture more of these critical minerals and keep them out of landfill.
That was Sercel's Ben Farrelly and Brent Murray there, speaking to The Wire's Tony Pankaluwik. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.